This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. Terror in Orlando, the latest on the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. On June 12th, Omar Mateen, an American-born citizen of Afghan immigrants, killed 49 people and injured more than 50 others at Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. Authorities say he made a 911 emergency call declaring his allegiance to the terrorist group known as the Islamic State and its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, before he was shot and killed hours later. Well, 8 days after the deadliest mass shooting in American history, the U.S. Senate voted down a series of proposals to restrict those on a variety of federal terror watch lists from buying firearms. More recently, a group of Democrats in the House of Representatives staged a sit-in to demand a vote on gun safety measures, such as instituting comprehensive background checks and preventing individuals on terror watch lists from being able to purchase a firearm. Well, Mr. Mateen's killing spree focuses attention on the problem of easy access to guns and on homophobia. But it also shows that the United States has a problem with homegrown jihadis. While there is no evidence that Omar Mateen was being directed by militants of the Islamic State, he was very possibly radicalized online. Well, with us to discuss what we know about the motivations and ramifications of the massacre and what combination of measures should be adopted to prevent it from happening again are James Carafano. He's vice president and director of the Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and that's a policy group based here in Washington. And P.J. Crowley, he's former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs under the Obama administration. Currently, he's professor and distinguished fellow at the Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communication at George Washington University. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
It's good to be with you.
Pleasure.
It's been a while since you've been back at these microphones, but I'm so delighted to have you both back again.
So we should warn people that PJ and I have been doing this for about 15 years.
Exactly.
We do look a day younger.
You both look very youthful. Well, James Carafano, seriously, now let's get to our topic. Another mass shooting, this one, though, in the middle of a contentious and polarizing presidential campaign. It seems to be a lone wolf, radicalized very possibly online, but it's also a hate crime. He attacked a gay nightclub. He himself may have had gay tendencies. It's hard to know. There's so many aspects to this. What's your takeaway from this terrible massacre?
Well, first, I do think we ought to make a distinction between something that's a mass shooting in which the shooter's motivation could be anything. Because in those scenarios, regardless of the cause of what they did, there was a whole sequence of public safety responses and countermeasures that you take regardless. And so that's a whole different conversation. As an incident of Islamist terrorism against the United States, the most remarkable thing about this terrorist attack is there's nothing remarkable about this terrorist attack. One of the things we do at Heritage is we have a timeline, a database of Islamist terror plots aimed at the United States since 9/11. By our count, this is number 86. Increasingly, in the last several years, this fits into a very clear pattern that we've seen. Out of the 22 last cases, almost all of them involved a U.S. citizen, a U.S. person, somebody who's already here. This is a mode of attack of several that we've seen in the past. The biography of the person is not something that's unusual. What's interesting, though, is when you look at this group, other than the fact that, if you want to call it homegrown terrorism, it's very disparate. Different people, different targets, different weapons, different parts of the country. So in that respect, there is no clear pattern. But that, again, reflects, I think, what we've seen here is we don't have in the United States extensive extremist networks and groups for people to plug into. So we're seeing this radicalization in small groups. I personally don't find the lone wolf distinction terribly helpful because almost nobody's a true lone wolf in the sense that they talk to no one, have contact with no one, give no indicators at all. For example, in this case, we know at least he had contact and discussions with his wife and maybe other people as well. But it's reflective of the nature of the Islamist terror threat that we see in the United States today.
P.J. Crowley, your take.
I agree with everything that Jim just said. And I think it's important to recognize the evolution of the threat and the evolution of the conflict that we have been experiencing for the last 15 years. This is a very different war, you know, than the one that bin Laden started. And so you do have with the Islamic State a different phenomenon. Now, we don't know yet whether his declaration of allegiance to al-Baghdadi is something that came towards the end of a cycle of radicalization where he was intent on committing murder and then tried to put a religious veneer on it. That's entirely possible. But this is a very different kind of challenge for the United States than what we saw on 9/11. And the threat is evolving from plots that are developed from outside the country, and then you have a cell of people that penetrates the United States and then, you know, commits the kind of spectacular attack that we saw on 9/11. Now you do have individuals, do-it-yourself terrorism, radicalization in place, and we'll have to continue to try to understand that dynamic. We've been very successful in intercepting some of these plots. We've been very successful intercepting people that have tried to go from the United States to join the caliphate in Syria. But again, I think this also reflects a maturing in terms of how the United States, the American people, you know, respond to this. We've had a number of plots that have been unsuccessful. We've had 3, 4, or 5, depending how you count, in the last couple of years, you know, that have been successful, you know, the Boston Marathon bombing. But I think the American people are beginning to understand, as Jim said, because this is such a random, disparate threat, that we're just going to have to absorb these, learn from them, see what else we can do in terms of improving public safety. But this is a dimension of the struggle that we're going to be coping with for the indefinite future.
Well, back to you, James Carafano. As I said earlier, it's a presidential campaign, a lot of politics, politicizing of this horrific massacre. The Republicans are insisting that this gentleman who did pledge this allegiance to ISIS, but for which we have no actual evidence, that this is an incident related to radical Islam. The Democrats, on the other hand, aren't necessarily denying that, but they're saying this easy access to guns here in the United States is also part of the problem. You have a lone wolf, radicalized potentially, and also easy access to guns. So we've seen recently both the Senate and the House of Representatives trying to take up measures, all of which have so far failed. One, to institute comprehensive background checks, because there are many loopholes right now where some who are on a terrorist watch list can still, as this gentleman was, have access to firearms. So here's the question to you. To what extent do you think this could, not just for this incident, but at least some kind of gun safety reform? I know we've tried many times and failed, but it looks like maybe have we reached a turning point? Do you think a bipartisan compromise can be reached such that something can be done to reduce access and at least reduce casualties in such a situation?
So I'm a counterterrorism expert, so that's the perspective that I examine the public safety and the public problem mission there. So there's no question it is a terrorist attack. If you look at the elements of a terrorist attack, it is the use or threat of violence. Clearly you have that. Directed at innocents, right? Clearly you have that. These are civilians. They have no military role whatsoever. And then for a political purpose. And we don't know, you know, his inner motivations and everything else, but clearly his declaration had all the attributes of exactly the kinds of things ISIS would want somebody to say. The declaration of allegiance to al-Baghdadi and other elements. So it was a political declaration, regardless if he had other motivations or whatever. When we look at dealing with the terrorist threat, and PJ is absolutely right. I mean, look, what are you looking for? If you had every person that's been involved in a known terrorist plot against the United States, about 200 and some odd people. If you had every case of no material assistance, somebody helping a terrorist trying to get somebody funding or get them a foreign fighter or some other country, material support, that's another 500 something. So you're looking for a population of about less than 1,000 people in a country of 320 plus million, the size of a continent. And when, you know, amateurs talk about this stuff, they talk about what's the target? You know, are they going after shopping malls or are they going after the mall in Washington, D.C.? And if you just think about it from a logical perspective, so what you're saying is you're focusing on the 5% of an attack in which a terrorist virtually has unlimited choices. I can pick a gun. I can pick a pressure cooker. I can drive my car over people. I mean, and when you're in a free society, you have almost an infinite number of things you want. And there's almost an infinite number of what we call soft targets, right? Things where you can readily gain access to. There isn't difficult security. So focusing on that is almost always a losing proposition. And we know this because, as PJ pointed out, we've had 86 known, at least known terrorist plots since 9/11, the overwhelming number of them thwarted. And how were they stopped? And they were stopped by law enforcement and intelligence actions going out and finding terrorists and stopping before they attack. So if you focus on the 95% of the terrorist plot that kind of looks the same, getting equipment, practicing, rehearsing, talking to other people, planning, fundraising, communicating. Find the people with the bad intent. That's how you stop them. If you look at how we dealt with organized crime, we didn't deal with organized crime by going out and looking for cigarette smugglers or, you know, hitmen. We went out and we looked out for people that were involved in criminal conspiracies.
So he was on a terror watch list. He was removed. So he was on. He has been flagged by counterterrorism officials. So what you're saying is having a no-fly, no-buy, as they call this legislation with respect to gun safety, that wouldn't have made a difference, and it won't make a difference in the future.
Well, it wouldn't have affected this individual case. And of course, I mean, we can talk through the list. I mean, I think people are confused when they say the terrorist watch list. They think that there's one list of everything, and there's not. There's a terrorist screening center which shares and compiles information with several lists that are used for several different purposes. So, for example, the no-fly list has a lot of people on there. And there's absolutely no due process whatsoever. So denying somebody a gun merely for the fact they were on no-fly list, it wouldn't pass constitutional muster.
All right, let me turn to PJ for your take on whether or not at least attention to gun safety reform here in the United States could have made a difference either in this case or could make a difference in the future, not just in terrorist incidents of this nature, but just in reducing these horrific massacres. So the question is, of course, mass shootings do happen in countries with strict gun laws, but they are far more frequent, analysts say, here in America.
I mean, the short answer is yes. I mean, I think there are two issues here. And I like the way that Jim framed this in terms of we are dealing with a public safety issue of which jihadism or terrorism is one element. So trying to figure out who might have had contact with law enforcement. One of the Boston bombers had been interviewed by the FBI based on an alert from Russia. Was he a suspect? Yes. Had he committed a crime? No. We may find in the case of Mateen, you know, he had been queried by the FBI again in connection with a couple of situations, but had not necessarily committed a crime. So you do have a very significant constitutional question. People have rights in this country, and this is part of the challenge for law enforcement. At a broader level, you might say as a legitimate policy objective, if somebody is on a terror watch list, you know, one of the vernaculars here is that if somebody can't board an airplane, should they have access to an AR-15? And we'll say intuitively, probably not. But then how do you put that into practice? And then will a modest change in our laws have the desired effect? Maybe, maybe not. You know, as Jim said, if you're intent on committing a terrorist act in the United States and you operate below the radar, you're going to find a weapon of some kind. By the same token, if we broaden the aperture here based not just on what happened in San Bernardino, what happened in Orlando, you know, what happened in Atlanta and Charleston, what happened in Newtown, Connecticut, you might say, are there too many guns in America? Probably. But here we reach right into a major political divide.
Right.
And the odds are, you know, we'll do something symbolic, but the odds are we're not yet as a society prepared to address that larger question.
Yeah, to follow up on that, I think that's right. I mean, you could have different views on gun control, and I'm not a gun control expert, but what you've done is you've sucked an ongoing debate, an illegitimate debate, right, into the middle of a very difficult emotional moment. And it's very, very difficult to make reasonable policies going forward. I mean, look, so 380 million guns in the United States. And, you know, if you look at government statistics, it says gun violence is at a 30-year low. It's been flat for 15 years. A third of the gun crimes are actually handguns, and a vast majority of gun violence is people committing suicide. So, I mean, I'm not going to argue for or against. There's a whole, I mean, it's a legitimate debate to have about what's appropriate gun safety, because actually it's not about gun control, right? We have gun control in America. We have gun laws. The question is are they efficacious and do they pass constitutional muster? Legitimate debate. It's not really a counterterrorism debate.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are James Carafano, from whom you just heard. He's vice president and director of the Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. That's a policy group here in Washington. And P.J. Crowley, he's former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs. He's currently professor and distinguished fellow at the Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communication at George Washington University, also based here in Washington. And we're discussing lessons learned and the policy implications of the mass shooting in Orlando, Florida. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com. We'll back to you again, James Carafano, to talk more about the FBI, counterterrorism authorities, and their ability to track these types of potential suspects. Do they have the tools they need, in your view, as we look back at this horrific massacre, to do what they need to do, to be more vigilant, to catch somebody like Omar Mateen before, you know, he commits this horrific massacre?
You know, so generally, I would say, I don't think we're in bad shape. You know, if you look at the FBI, for example, there was a commission that reported out last year with Ed Meese, former attorney general, and Bruce Hoffman, a well-known counterterrorism expert that PGI and I both know well, actually wasn't an A grade, but it actually gave, I think, pretty responsible thing. The FBI is taking this seriously. If you look at our track record, it's pretty good. I think it's a question of the application in that particular instant, and are there things to do or learn from that. And that, I think, is we have to kind of wait and see. So PJ mentioned a couple of the attacks that we've had in recent years, and I think you can already start, you can parse some of those. So for example, I think if you look at shooting at Fort Hood and in San Bernardino, both in retrospect, we can look and say, you know what, and not just law enforcement, but there are things that could and should have been done which might have preempted these events. On the other hand, I think if you look at the Boston bombing, even though we'd had some intelligence from the Russians, if you look at what the FBI did, I think an honest person would say pretty unreasonable to expect that these guys were going to find this out. The only thing that would have saved that situation is just better public safety, better security at the venue. I think in this case, it's too soon to tell. I think we just have to wait to have all the information about who knew what, when, and how they exercised the authorities and responsibilities that they had. This is a tough thing for the FBI, remember, because the whole thing is to catch somebody before they have an attack. So they're making these hard decisions every day about who do I focus on. And they looked at this guy, and this guy looks pretty sketchy, let's be honest, right?
Exactly.
And so think about this, though. If they're saying, you know what, I've got more important cases than this, that's kind of scary.
That is indeed, and that's why I'm asking this question. So, PJ, based on what we know from this massacre and previous ones that have an Islamist terrorist link, do we have the right tools? Do our counterterrorism officials, whether the FBI or others, do they have the right tools? Or are they looking at, you know, the psychology of these individuals sufficiently enough? What have we learned from this that may have preempted this event or at least helps us going forward?
What we've learned is that despite best efforts by law enforcement, individuals are going to do horrific things. The odds are still that unless you do something that brings yourself to the attention of law enforcement and you operate under the radar and you want to get to a soft target, chances are you're going to get that opportunity.
Quickly,
you
know, though, but, I mean, he was on this terror watch list. He had, you know, he made these statements that he wants to, you know, kill people.
FBI director,
domestic violence.
FBI director James Comey said that we'll go back over the contacts that we had and did we miss something? And the answer is maybe. But I, you know, as a baseball fan, for example, you cannot expect law enforcement to bat 1,000 and then sustain the constitutional protections that are at the heart of what we're trying to do. We're trying to fight terrorism without changing the fundamental nature of the country. But we have to put this in context. I think if I'm optimistic about how we've evolved, we're less prone to overreact than we perhaps were, you know, 15 years ago. But there are competing issues here.
Back to you, James Carafano, as we conclude. Certainly, we will need a multi-pronged approach to try to prevent this type of massacre in the future. Whether one agrees or not with better gun safety laws, that may be one measure. And also, we have to look at, you know, the fight against the so-called Islamic State, Islamist extremism around the world. Are we actually fostering, you know, more an attraction to these types of, for this type of, because some criticize the U.S. approach to fighting the Islamic State. You look at Syria, and you're fighting the Islamic State on one hand, but not necessarily addressing the fact that Bashar al-Assad is a magnet for more recruits. So I'd like your view on, you know, going forward. And we now have a political campaign. You have Donald J. Trump on the one hand, the Republican nominee, and Hillary Clinton the Democratic nominee, talking about what measures need to be taken. Mr. Trump saying, you know, we need to ban Muslims still. He's saying we need surveillance in Muslim communities. Hillary Clinton saying that's really not the answer because, first of all, he was an American citizen, this Omar Mateen. Yes, his parents were immigrants, but really, again, balancing values or democratic values against how to prevent these types of things, that wouldn't have made a difference. And we can't surveil Muslim communities because we actually need to cultivate our Muslim communities so that they can flag somebody like Omar Mateen in the future. So how do you come down on these various approaches by the presidential nominees and just in general, the multi-pronged approach we need to adopt?
Well, I think that's a really good end on. If you always play defense, eventually the other guy's going to score. So there is an offensive component to this, and the Islamist narrative drives this global activity. And so that is an important element, and it is a motivating factor. And we actually have seen in the past where Islamist violence has been defeated and rolled back, we have seen global terrorism subside after the defeat in the Sunni triangle and defeat in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda's stock in 2008 was actually pretty low. As ISIS has suffered defeats in the field, foreign fighters have started to dry up, contacts have started to dry up. So defeating the narrative, which is that we have a declared caliphate and we are accomplishing a historical end, is important. So that is, I think, an important part of the fight, not just defending against terrorist attacks at home, but dealing with the expansion of ISIS and the reemergence of al-Qaeda overseas as well.
And PJ, you get the last word because James didn't really address, you know, the duel between the political candidates.
Look, what people say on the, I mean, you know, you talk to a global audience and what people say on the campaign trail is about politics and trying to get elected. So anybody that tries to parse out of that a responsible counterterrorism policy from either candidate, I'm just telling you, you're kind of wasting your time. Yeah.
Okay, just the question is, though, in particular on Mr. Trump's side, though, this insistence that we need to surveil Muslim communities or ban Muslims, many are critical, thinking that this is just not a good idea, not from the point of view only of American values, but particularly it's just not good counterterrorism. So you may want to address that.
I don't think it's good, you know, counterterrorism. We have done, I think, good work over recent years to try to beat back the perception that the United States is at war with Islam. I think we've been fairly successful in that. And so Trump's call for a ban, which, oh, by the way, was irrelevant to Orlando, you know, I think has weakened him in terms of his political standing as we now move from the primary campaign where some of his rhetoric worked to his advantage, you know, now to the general election where I think it's going to work to his disadvantage. But I think that we make a mistake here if we personalize this. I would say that we have to understand that this is going to be a long-term challenge that's going to probably outlast the next president of the United States over one or two terms. You know, we've gone from al-Qaeda as the network of choice to the Islamic State as the entity of choice. Even when the Islamic State fails, there's going to be some other flavor of the moment we're going to be dealing with some time. And I think this is a reflection of how the threat has evolved. To me, this has not bin Laden's war. Bin Laden's war was about the United States, its presence in the region, and its policy. This is far more, to me, now a war within Islam in terms of Islam's relationship to the modern world and Islam's ability to exist in that modern world and what level of tolerance that it will experience. And I think that inner struggle was exactly what, you know, Mateen was working through. And now you take that and blow that up. So I think the decisive actions here are going to happen in the Middle East. The Arab Spring has complicated the struggle to a great extent. You know, but the United States has a great stake in what happens here. We have things that we need to do.
Such as?
You know, well, we need to be vigilant. But I think that we've tried to figure out how to shape events in the Middle East without inserting ourselves into conflicts, the resolution of which will happen in the region, as opposed to the resolution being a solution imposed, you know, from an outsider like the United States.
Yeah, I agree with that.
All right, we end on a note of agreement. I'm afraid that is all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, James Carafano, Vice President at the Heritage Foundation, and P.J. Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, now professor at George Washington University. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming on, sharing your insights.
Always a pleasure, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Chiang Wong. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.